the headline in yesterday's paper read, Illinois joins states funding stem cell research. Now, that term stem cell research can either be good news or bad news. You read on in the story, well, news does not sound as good as one might have hoped. We're going to be talking about this $10 million in grants awarded by Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich for stem cell research. Mary Ann Hackett joins us here for the next 10 minutes, president of Illinois Right to Life. After our conversation with Mary Ann, we will turn to audio open lines for your questions and your comments. We've got quite a bit of audio to play for you. And then in the third hour, we'll be reviewing a sermon by Pastor Bill Swirla, an Easter sermon during this Easter season. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address issues etc@kfuo.org. Mary Ann Hackett is president of Illinois Right to Life. Mary Ann, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd. Happy to be with you.
How much of this money, this $10 million, do you think is going to go for embryonic stem cell research?
Well, the governor says only one-fifth of it. But, you know, the problem is that the legislature three times defeated the stem cell bills, the research bills, and then the governor just slipped in the $10 million in the budget for, quote, scientific research. And I think his behavior is questionable at best because we don't know who is reviewing the grants. He apparently decided on the grants, decided on the protocol, decided on the applications. And he said before and has said essentially in the article I read today that he thinks democracy runs too slowly and he wasn't going to be bothered with the legislator. You know, this is taxpayer money. And also it has really ethical implications to it.
Doesn't the Illinois legislature, if it's comparable to the way that the national legislature runs, doesn't the Illinois legislature at some point really have the purse strings of the state of Illinois in their grasp rather than the governor?
Well, absolutely. He just slipped this $10 million in. And, you know, there's a real argument against embryonic stem cell research. The biggest argument, besides the taking of human life, which it does, is that the results, the successes, have been zero. There have been no successes from embryonic research. All of the successes have come from adult stem cell research and umbilical cord. The interesting thing is that they always say the pro-lifers, the conservatives, are against stem cell research. Nothing could be farther from the truth. We support it wholeheartedly, but we are opposed to embryonic stem cell research because it kills the child.
The promise made by the governor here in a written statement is the promise of stem cell research is unlimited. We need to do everything we can to help our scientists and researchers make the most of it.
Well,
doesn't sound like the promise is unlimited yet.
There is no promise. In fact, leading researchers around the world are coming forward saying that the claims for embryonic stem cell research are highly exaggerated, and that there have been great results from other types of research into adult stem cells and umbilical cord stem cells. In fact, the National Congress just passed a bill and signed by the president to set up a bank for umbilical cord blood so it would be available to people for research. Almost every week something comes out of stem cell research that has been productive in curing disease and showing improvements in diseases, nothing from embryonic stem cell research. And the legislature, that's the whole purpose of the legislature, is to set guidelines, to approve a budget for various things. The governor doesn't believe in democracy, obviously.
What is the Judy Bartopinka, who is a former leader of the Republican Party? She's Republican treasurer in Illinois. It seems miffed that the governor has snuck this around the legislature. What would you expect? Does she have other objections? Does she object to this on the basis of its ethical problems?
Well, I haven't heard her situation or her opinion or her position on that. I don't know, but I think she is objecting to the same thing we're all objecting to. What right has he to spend $10 million of the taxpayer money on research that he thinks is good? I mean, does that allow him to just put in $10 million for any research he thinks is good? I mean, we have a democracy here that we're supposed to be voting on, you know, and it's our money. It's our money, and it's morally unethical to use it for those things. He says one-fifth, but even one-fifth of the $10 million is too much to spend on killing babies.
In California, a year or so ago, they had a taxpayer referendum. They voted through $3 billion of taxpayer money for embryonic stem cell research, and that money, the tap on that money, has been pretty well closed.
That's right,
for
because
various reasons.
Of lawsuits preventing it. And also, New Jersey had passed a stem cell research bill, embryonic stem cell, but the legislature, I think, declined to give the money for it.
Well, what recourse do the voters in Illinois have over against Rod Blagojevich's end run around the legislature and earmarking money for embryonic stem cell research?
Well, I can only imagine that we would be able to ask the legislature to introduce legislation that would stop the funding or prevent any state funds from going into this project. He's already given grants to three or four hospitals to give it. I mean, the governor apparently decided who would apply, how they would apply, and he's given the grants already. I don't know what they can do now that the horse is out of the barn, but I certainly they can prevent any further money from going to this, but I think they intend to prevent any further money. He wants to put an additional $15 million in this year's budget, which would begin in July, and apparently that's failing. And I have to attribute it to the calls and letters of the people of Illinois to prevent it, because there's been phone trees activated all over the state to stop this. But you know, a governor that acts as a dictator, our only recourse, I suppose, is to remove him from office, to vote him out of office.
He says, or at least indicated from what he tried to get through the legislature previously, the governor says that he hopes for $100 million for biomedical research in the next several years. What would that really mean?
Well, it would mean that he would use $100 million of our tax money, but in a state that has real financial problems, where is he going to get it? The interesting thing is that the private researchers and private firms no longer want to fund embryonic stem cell research because it's unproductive. And the only way they can get money for it is through the taxpayers, through the government, through legislatures and passing bills and setting aside money for it, because private research knows that the claims are exaggerated, and they'd rather do the research on productive ways that really produce cures. And so what's happening now is they're trying to pressure state governments into giving the funds for this. And one thing I think doesn't come up is that once they develop things in under embryonic research, they begin to patent these things. And there's a lot of money in patents. That's how they hope to reclaim their funds, these research organizations.
Folks, for the latest information on pro-life issues in Illinois, check out the website for Illinois Right to Life, illinoisrighttolife.org, illinoisrighttolife.org. Marianne Hackett is president of Illinois Right to Life. Marianne, thanks for being our guest.
Well, thank you for bringing this up. It's a very important subject, and we all need to be alerted to it. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Well, we've got open lines ahead here. It's audio open lines for the remainder of this hour. We've got an awful lot to play, probably more than we'll ever get to. But we start with an update. You know, we've been doing that Dan Brown Da Vinci Code courtroom update thing. They have this whole courtroom trial, and Dan Brown's trying to answer for what he allegedly plagiarized some stuff from the Holy Blood, the Holy Grail. He came out of that smelling like a rose. I mean, literally smelling like a rose. All the free advertising he ever could have wanted. People ready to watch his movie. All the more interested in the book and the movie. Dan Brown, author of The Da Vinci Code, spoke Sunday on a New Hampshire public radio station. It was billed as his only public appearance before next month's release of this blockbuster movie. You know it will be. his that movie version of his popular novel, The Da Vinci Code. Let's hear some of what Dan Brown had to say. What does he think about the movie? Apparently he's seen it.
The movie version of The Da Vinci Code is mesmerizing. This movie reminds me of why I loved movies as a kid.
Now, would you expect him to say anything else? After all, it's his movie. It's his book. It's his baby. So many people found his novel mesmerizing. Many people found his novel the best read they'd had in years. And with a director like Ron Howard and stars like Tom Hanks, it better be a good movie. I mean, at least in terms of entertainment values. Dan Brown says he's aware of the Christian response to the novel and to the upcoming film.
In the next month with the movie coming out, many churches are enthusiastically poised to take advantage of the surge of interest in our religious history. They are embracing the controversy.
Okay, I don't know what that means, but I got a question for you. Do you plan to see the movie? Whether it be in the theaters or whether it be on DVD, like if you're like me, you wait till a lot of these things come out on DVD. Whether you've embraced the controversy or whether you have eschewed the novel, do you plan to see the movie? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's audio open lines. Dan Brown, the author of The Da Vinci Code, says that Christianity has absolutely nothing to fear from his novel or the film.
Christian theology has survived the writings of Galileo and the writings of Darwin. Surely it will survive the writings of some novelist from New Hampshire. So, thank you.
Well, he's right. I mean, it will survive. It will. The gates of hell will not prevail against it. But that doesn't mean that people of perhaps naive sensibilities won't be misled. And, you know, he talked about the church embracing the controversy. There are churches, I drove past one just the other day, that had on its sign outside, you know, it advertises the things it's doing. They're teaching a Bible class, so-called Bible class, on the Da Vinci Code. And this church, it happened to be United Church of Christ, thinks the Da Vinci Code is a great idea. Fits beautifully with their version of how things might have really happened. You know, that's the church that's doing the ad campaign, God is still speaking, and don't put a period where God has put a comma. Kind of the ongoing reevaluation, reinvention, rethinking of the Christian faith. And apparently Dan Brown's novel is not something to be responded to or refuted, but something to be applauded in that church. Now, Dan Brown's thinking the same thing. He says religion, it changes with the times like everything else.
Religion is a work in progress. We learn from its mistakes. We evolve and mature. And exactly that is what keeps religion relevant and exciting.
You know, those of you out there who have bought into the buzzword relevance should listen very carefully to Dan Brown. That is really the end game of this tyranny of relevance. Oz Guinness wrote this book called Prophetic Untimeliness, where he talks about the idol of relevance in the Christian church and how a church that bows down to the idol of relevance automatically makes itself irrelevant because it abandons the very thing that made the church relevant in the first place. The biblical message of the gospel, Jesus Christ for sinners. Sooner or later, no matter how hard people try to keep it from happening, that is what comes under attack when it comes to bowing down to the idol of relevance. Now, there's Dan Brown, author of The Da Vinci Code, saying, look, what keeps religion, and here he's talking about Christianity because his book is about the real history of Christianity, what keeps religion relevant in this world, in this changing world, is that it changes. It's a work in progress. It kind of learns from its own mistakes. It goes this way and then maybe corrects itself. And that's what keeps it fresh. That's what keeps it relevant. That's what relevant means today. If you would bow to the idol of relevance or what the culture says is relevant, you're going to find yourself with Dan Brown sooner or later. Even if you don't want to, against your own will, you will find yourself with Dan Brown. Famous saying that the church that marries the spirit of the age is destined to be a widow because the spirit of the age constantly changes. The culture always promises the church relevance. That's the one thing the culture can promise to the church. It's the one thing that the culture can never deliver. But it promises the church relevance. Do this, compromise this, say this, follow us, the culture, and we will guarantee that we'll call you relevant. But it's the one thing that the culture can't deliver. Because the source of true relevance is what the church always had all along, and sadly must abandon to fit the culture's definition of relevance. What makes it relevant? It is what makes the church the church. The relevance of the church is not found in how it responds to the culture, or how it tailors its message or tailors its method to the culture. The relevance of the church is found in its message. Jesus Christ for sinners. Now, don't get me wrong. The world does not consider this message relevant, but that's irrelevant. Whether or not the culture considers the message of the gospel relevant is beside the point. This is nothing new. St. Paul had to deal with this as well. I mean, he put it in terms of the dominant cultures of his day and of his era. He says, Jews, what are they looking for? Signs. That's what they consider to be relevant. The Greeks, what do they consider to be relevant? Wisdom. What do we give them instead, says Paul? Weakness and foolishness of what we preach. Since God in his wisdom did not reveal himself through human wisdom, but through the foolishness of what we preach, that's what we preach, Christ and him crucified for sinners. Now, to the world, it's foolishness, and to the world, it's weakness. But the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. You know what Paul's talking about? He's talking about a church that's really, truly relevant. And nothing's changed. The times have changed, but nothing else. Dan Brown says that the controversy that is surrounding the Da Vinci Code, it helps people with their religious beliefs.
The more vigorously we all consider and debate these topics, the better our understanding of our own spirituality.
Now, I agree with that. I agree with that 100%. I think Christians ought to be thanking God for Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code. Not because what he says is true, but because what he has written there, its popularity, all of the things go along with it, give us a golden opportunity to give an answer for the hope that is in us. It creates the questions, the conversation, the debate, the dialogue right there for us. Who was it we were talking to? Chris Roseborough, who said that he was going to do a Bible class on the Da Vinci Code. And I think it was Chris who said recently on the program that he thought the Da Vinci Code was the best opportunity the church has had in a long time in popular culture to respond with the truth. And all those opportunities are always there. Here's Dan Brown one more time. He's author of The Da Vinci Code. And he said Sunday on New Hampshire Public Radio that his book likely led to the increased interest in a recent translation of, you've heard about this one, the Gospel of Judas.
Interest in the Judas Gospel probably would not have been as intense if The Da Vinci Code were not sort of part of the culture right now. And I think it's wonderful. I think it's terrific that people are asking these sorts of questions.
And we need to be ready to answer them. It is terrific that people are asking these questions. And we need to be ready to answer them. Do you know that that's really one of the reasons, I think, why God permits these errors, these kinds of ideas to flourish, both in the culture and in the religious sphere? Why would God allow the Mormons to promulgate and propagate their soul-damning error? Why? He could snap his fingers and make it all go away. Why would he permit this to happen? To give us an opportunity to give an answer for the hope that's in us. To speak of the true relevance of the church. To speak of the truth in opposition to the error. That's why it's here. The goal, by the way, folks, people might get the wrong impression from this program. The goal is not the elimination of error in the culture. It's never going to happen. The goal is to use it as the opportunity it is to respond with the truth. The light of the truth is never so brightly seen and perceived as when set side by side with the darkness of error. And the danger of error, the comfort of the truth of Jesus Christ, is all the sweeter when shown in contrast to the danger of error inside the church, outside the church. Now, 50 religious leaders have signed a joint letter calling for Senate passage of the Federal Marriage Amendment, the proposed amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which would define marriage as the union of a man and a woman, supposed to be voted on in the Senate in less than 6 weeks. The letter was signed by Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, Christian, Mormon, Jewish leaders all together. Let's hear more about this religious coalition from Matt Daniels, president of Alliance for Marriage. That's the organization.
Seeing faith communities that are huge in terms of their membership unite their voice to speak to this issue of protecting marriage in anticipation of the June vote on our amendment in the Senate.
So what we have here is pan-religious. Now, here's a good case for where cooperation in externals, as the theologians used to say it, we're cooperating in things that are of social, political, and moral importance is one of the things the church is called to do, even hand in hand with other religions. Now, that's to be distinguished from giving the impression in any way that what we believe is the same as the Mormons or the Orthodox or the Jews or it, you name it. People that we could not, that we cannot worship with, that we cannot pray with, as a matter of principle, as a matter of upholding the truth, we would be happy to sign a petition with to pass something like the Federal Marriage Amendment. Now, the Federal Marriage Amendment may or may not be a good idea. It may be the only thing we can do in the face of creeping redefinition of marriage. But here is where these groups who have a common cause can come together. More from Matt Daniels on this letter that was signed by these religious leaders favoring a federal marriage amendment.
They share a common vision of marriage as the union of male and female. They speak for vast numbers of Americans, and they're doing so through the vehicle of RCM.org, which is a website that we've established to allow people of faith to make their voice heard on this debate in Congress.
Now, the debate, it is encouraging to see that the debate will be coming to the Senate. I wonder what its prospects will be. And we can sign all the letters or go to all the websites we want to. It really comes down to how 100 men and women in the U.S. Senate will finally vote on a federal marriage amendment. That's what it really comes down to. And we can garner all the support and get all the signatures we need. Daniel says that people of faith can contact lawmakers through New Religious Coalition for Marriage and their website.
We have a huge segment of the American electorate supporting the cause of protecting marriage. We have faith communities that are enormous, and now they are being given the same web and email advocacy tools that the left uses, only in this case, through RCM.org, we're going to be using them to advance the cause of our marriage amendment.
So, people of all faiths, people of no faith, who want to see marriage preserved as one man, one woman, even by the last resort of a constitutional amendment, this is something they can get behind. Finally, here's Matt Daniels again, president of Alliance for Marriage. He is awaiting the Senate's vote in June.
Movements like this religious coalition working through the RCM.org website, these are reactions to an abuse of court power. And apart from our marriage amendment, we are going to see the courts strike down marriage for future generations. This is the last and best hope of Americans to have their values reflected in our laws.
Now, when he says last and best, I want to talk about that on the other side of the break. More audio open lines after this.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Pastor Scott Clems of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, talking about the goals for the young men who attend Christ Academy 2006.
Christ Academy allows high school men to become a full equal partner in the life of the seminary for 2 weeks every June. They attend chapel 4 times a day with the student body and faculty and staff. They go to classes for 3 or 4 hours a day, regular classes taught by the seminary faculty and staff. They become tight as a community and join together in prayer and greater understanding of Lutheran theology.
For more information about Christ Academy 2006 on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Theological Seminary, 1-800-481-2155. That's issuesetc.org or 1-800-481-2155.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Does your six-year-old have First Amendment rights? The Second Circuit Court of Appeals said yes, and the Supreme Court is letting that ruling stand by refusing to hear a controversial case. Antonio Peck made a poster of how to save the environment in his kindergarten class. It included a depiction of Jesus. When his poster was folded to hide the robed figure, his parents sued. Kim Troby reports on the victory for religious freedom.
It took a while. Antonio Peck is now a sixth grader, but he'll be pleased with the outcome. The Supreme Court refused to get involved, letting stand a ruling in the Second Circuit. Charles Haynes with the First Amendment Center likes the non-ruling, too.
This is good news for religious freedom, because I think this case should go forward and that the Peck family should have its day in court.
That day came some time ago when the lower court ruled unanimously that Peck's First Amendment rights were violated by the Baldwinsville, New York school district. Matt Staver with Liberty Counsel says the lower court can now apply its ruling.
Now, when we go back to apply this legal principle, it's essentially a done deal, since they've already testified and admitted under oath why they censored this poster.
The school district maintains they handled it appropriately, but they've already admitted to censoring the kindergartner's poster.
It'll also mean that they'll have to pay for this multi-year series of litigation because they have been so persistent, so determined to censor Christian viewpoints despite common sense and the Constitution. I think it sends a great and strong message to other school districts around the country. Do not discriminate against the Christian views of your students.
Haynes tells schools to educate themselves on the First Amendment so they can protect every student's right of religious freedom and expression. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
As long as students fulfill the requirements of an assignment, they have the right to express religious views. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob.
Turn on most other radio stations that are religious. Look at the sermons on television. We hardly ever hear the gospel. The true gospel, that we are declared righteous while we're still sinners. Before any improvement has begun, God declares us as saints. I want to say that again, because that's what the gospel is. That through faith in Jesus Christ, an individual is declared a saint.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker. Weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
This year, Mother's Day is May 14th, and our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is all about moms. It's titled Mommy Promises. This picture book for children ages 4 and up costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Mommy Promises is published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. More information is available on our website, issuesetc.org. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, Mommy Promises.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking a little bit here in Audio Open Lines about the Federal Marriage Amendment. Apparently within 6 weeks it might see the light of day in the Senate. That doesn't mean they're going to pass it. It just means they'll take up debate, which again is miles away from actually voting on it. What do you think of the prospects of something like this? We heard from the head of this new coalition, multi-faith coalition, that have signed petitions online and otherwise to see to it that the Senate takes this up. We heard from him. He says it's the best, or the last and the best hope for keeping marriage an issue of one man, one woman. Now, it's certainly the last. There is no recourse after an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. You do realize that, don't you? It's the last resort. The last legal recourse that can be taken in the U.S. And if it does not pass, well, think about all the other kind of amendments that have been attempted to the U.S. Constitution. If it does not pass, you can always try again. But again, you're trying again another last resort. Now, I guess by definition, if it's your last resort, it's your best, because you're left with no other resorts, right? No other options. So it's not only your last, it's your only option. Is it the only option that we have? I mean, we could fight it out state by state, but this federal marriage amendment would, in one fell swoop, undo things like Massachusetts and elsewhere where they have gay marriage, or the equivalent of gay marriage and same-sex unions, and would inscribe in stone from now on until, of course, you can change the amendment. You can re-amend the Constitution one more time to get rid of it. We've done that before. But it is the last and the best. It's sad that it would have to come to this. Now, given the fact that it is a big move to amend the U.S. Constitution, kind of like happens a couple times in a century, kind of a big move, on this very issue, what do you think its prospects are? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Do we need a federal marriage amendment to the U.S. Constitution? Do we need the Constitution defining that marriage within the bounds of the United States will be one man, one woman? Do you think it'll pass the Senate? And then, if it does, following the normal path of these things, will it get enough voters past a Senate vote? That is, you and me, state-by-state referendum, will it get 35 states to amend the U.S. Constitution? What do you think? I mean, I'm not saying it isn't worth trying. I'm just asking you, realistically, do you think it can be done? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Audio open lines continues. Here's another subject. This comes from the Associated Press. An upcoming report by the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom will raise alarms about Islamic extremism in Pakistan and the rights for non-Muslims in Afghanistan. Those two have both been in the news of late. The Federal Commission is also expected to renew its call for tougher measures against nations such as Saudi Arabia, one of our allies, China, not our ally, unless they work to end religious persecution. The president of China was meeting with George W. Bush this last week and over the weekend. While the annual report to be released next week is not final and could change, the commission officials interviewed by the Associated Press offered outlines of its priorities. Let's hear some of those priorities from Michael Cromartie. He's chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom.
We have this very important war on terror, but some of the countries that are allies are also countries that have their own problems with religious extremism, and so you have to do a delicate diplomatic dance with what to say about such countries.
You know, it occurs to me we should have talked with Serge Trifkovic about this very issue, too, because we just need to get him back on again. Because in the first half hour, we talked with him about the formation of this unity government in Iraq. And he writes in his book on terrorism called Defeating Jihad, he writes that there is one big peril in democratizing the Middle East. It's called Islam. Where democracies flourish in Islamic nations, Islamic extremism rises. I'm not talking about insurgency or terrorism. I'm talking about Islamism. Because these democracies are writing constitutions, Iraq's is no exception, Afghanistan's is no exception, that say everything that's said here in the Constitution is fine and good, but nothing of it can or can be construed to conflict with the Quran. That one clause renders religious freedom in those countries pretty much null and void and sets Sharia law as really the ultimate law of the land. So while they've got democracy, while they've got voting, and by the way, when they vote in majorities, guess who they elect? Islamists. Showing that democracy, while it is great, is no panacea. And while the voting place is a great place, if they're voting for the wrong people, they're voting for the wrong people. So you've got the law in the Constitution, and then you have the law on the street, Sharia, which outweighs the Constitution. It's a little bit as if, it's a very backward way of thinking about constitutional democracy. It's a little bit as if we said here in the United States, I think this was Dr. John Warwick Montgomery who pointed this out when we were talking about it some time back. It's almost as if we were to say here in the U.S., the Constitution is the ultimate law, but the laws of local towns and cities and their laws override it. The Constitution can hardly be the ultimate law of the land and can at the same time have the rug pulled out from underneath it by local authorities. It should be the other way around. That's the way it works here. But not in Islamist countries. Cromartie says that the commission has an annual list of the worst countries in terms of religious persecution.
purpose of such a list is to point out the human rights abuses in those countries, call attention to them, and to give a marker for countries to conform to. In many cases, we've actually seen countries trying to do better because of abuses that have been pointed out to them.
Now, I'd like to know what those cases are. I'm not an expert on world affairs. I'm not. And I don't watch the globe all the time. But I can't think of an example of a country having been put on one of these lists, and they come out every year or so from the State Department, these lists of biggest offenders when it comes to religious freedom. I can't think of one that said, oh, golly, we didn't know things had gotten this bad. They put us on this bad list. We're gonna change our ways. It's not that they haven't expressed concern, but has anything changed? In terms of religious freedom, are we better off on the globe than we were 20 years ago? The chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom says that most nations don't want to be labeled countries of particular concern. That's the CPC that they talk about, countries of particular concern on this list of countries who deny human rights.
Few countries like North Korea that don't care what we say about anything. But then again, there are countries that take very seriously if they're labeled as repressive and unfree toward religious believers.
What I want to know is, what does it mean in terms of what we actually do? Who we trade with, who we help, who we send money to, how we have, what kind of relations we have with the country. What does it mean in actual terms like that? Okay, so for instance, China, not a safe place to be a member of Falun Gong. Remember the lady that was screaming while the president was speaking in that photo op that made the news? This Chinese expatriate physician? She's there. She's screaming about the abuse of people and the mistreatment of people and the jailing of people and the killing of people in this cult group called Falun Gong. Now, it's a cult. There's no two ways about it. But cults suffer under a lack of religious freedom just like legitimate religions do. And the fate of Christians in China, well, if you're a member of one of the state-sanctioned churches, that's all fine and good. But Christians in China, who number in the hundreds of millions, probably more Christians in China easily than in the U.S., they're reduced to house churches, secret house churches, without the approval, and if they're discovered, they can be punished, put in prison. So we have the president here from China, and before the president showed up, president of China showed up about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, President Bush said he was going to raise the issues of religious freedom with him, and that would be one of his top priorities. Did they talk about that in any of these public things? I wasn't paying attention, but did they talk about it? Did you hear anything from the president of China or from President Bush about religious freedom? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You hear about trade, you hear about all those other things. Maybe you heard something I didn't. Finally, Michael Cromartie of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom said that the commission's religious freedom reports do, in the end, have an impact.
When I first got on the commission, I wondered, does this matter that we just name these countries CPCs, Country of Particular Concerns? And much to my surprise, I found that actually means a lot to a lot of these countries and their embassies.
Well, dealing with the ambassador is different than dealing with the country, you know. Dealing with their embassies here on U.S. soil is different than dealing with the country itself. It's Audio Open Lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about the Book of Revelation with Pastor Robert Baker of Concordia Publishing House. Also, Stephen Parks is going to join us. We're going to talk about confession and forgiveness. And then Dr. Gene Smith is going to join us. You know, he is a former Greek Orthodox priest, and he's going to explain to us why the Orthodox wing of Christianity celebrated Easter 2 days ago, whereas Western Christianity and the rest of Christianity celebrated it 1 week and 2 days ago. Why the week discrepancy between the two? It has to do with some pretty complicated calendar maneuvers, but we'll be talking about that tomorrow on Issues, etc. It's Audio Open Lines for the next 15 minutes. I want to hear from you. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What's on your mind? Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, religion has grown into a multi-billion-dollar business. Let's say it this way. Religious merchandising has grown into a multi-billion-dollar business. This report from ABC.
Religion is big bucks these days. Last year, $7.5 billion was spent on religious items, from books to greeting cards. The whole industry has grown 28% in the last 3 years, according to a study by market researcher Packaged Facts. What's driving the growth? Two-thirds of adults in the United States say faith is important to them, according to Simmons Market Research. Books are the most popular religious purchase, accounting for almost $4 billion in sales. A further $2 billion was spent on inspirational gifts, including clothing and jewelry. And more than $1.5 billion went on educational software, CDs, and, amazingly, video games. The Packaged Facts study says the growth is due to crossover appeal. The religious-themed bestseller, The Da Vinci Code, appeals to a variety of readers, whatever their faith. Other trends are the rise in New Age literature since 9/11 and books on the Kabbalah, popularized by celebrities such as Madonna and Demi Moore. With the ABC News Money Minute, I'm Betsy Stark in New York.
Now, I found it interesting that you think religious merchandising and you think Jesus fish, what would Jesus do bracelets, Christian bookstores. That includes things like the Da Vinci Code, too, because it's religious themed and it's made a lot of money. Think about the box office from the Da Vinci Code film going into that big bankroll that is religious merchandising. I mean, I guess you could have a What Would Jesus Do Da Vinci Code bracelet, couldn't you? The answer would be different. Jesus would set up house with Mary Magdalene, have children, and beget a generation of Merovingians or something like that. But, you know, same question, what would Jesus do? You know, some people find it a little offensive. You walk in and it's, merchandising the faith. Christian books are the biggest thing, and the second biggest thing, to the tune of $1.5 billion annually. Software, CDs, that includes Christian music, and video games. Now, I like to play video games, love to play video games. I basically have built my last two computers for the sole purpose of being able to play video games. I don't have as much time to do it as I used to. Yes, I'm a loser. What do you do in your spare time, Craig?
Read.
Well, me too, actually. What do, Jeff? Try and stain a deck, an unstainable deck, yes. Beget more children. That's a good way to, yeah, that's a good way to spend your time.
I've been playing with my puppy lately.
You've been playing with your new dog. All right. I guess that beats video games. Of course, I haven't sat down to play a video game in weeks. I just don't have the time to do it. But, I don't know. Would you buy a Christian-themed video game? It's kind of like Christian comic books. It might be entertaining, but you're always going to think, yeah, but they got an ulterior motive here. Okay, you could have a Christian-themed video game. What would you do? Maybe have, instead of knights and gladiators or something like that, you might have, what, guys running around in clerical collars or Christians being persecuted in the catacombs. I don't know. I haven't seen one of them. How do you get Jesus into a video game? For it to be really Christian, it's got to have Jesus in it. Unless you're just talking about video games that are based upon Christian values, which is not technically Christian. That you could call that values-based video games. But how do you get Jesus into a video game? I mean, how do you do the... could you have like a, hanging with the disciples kind of a video game where you go around, you follow Jesus, you listen to him teach, he does a few miracles. You know where the story's going, right? I mean, if it's going to be Christian, you know where the story's going. You're going to put in Jerusalem on a hill with Jesus dead on a cross. Kind of predictable. Unless, of course, these video games aren't really Christian and what they are is just based on Christian values. In which case, a lot of the fun of the video game, I mean, think about this, a lot of the fun of the video game has to do with not keeping your values that Christian. You know, chopping someone's head off, shooting someone, even the cleanest of video games. Someone once wrote me and said, I got a problem with games. And I was curious.
This woman wrote me, this was years ago, she said, it seems to me that all games, whatever they may be, even Edwardsville basketball, involve deception. And can Christians play and enjoy these kind of games when they, by their very nature, involve deception? Okay, example, we were playing Clue the other night, me and my children. We're playing, I and my children, whatever, playing Clue. You know the old game, board game? You got your little people, you go around. The whole game is about conning everyone else in the game, isn't it? It's about asking questions and proposing, you know, calling someone to the room and saying, accuse them of the murder. It already starts with murder, for heaven's sakes. And it starts with the breaking of the fifth commandment. And then you start playing the game. And my daughter is a master at this because she can con the socks off of anybody. So we have played Clue probably 10 times since we brought the board game home. She's won every single time. She declares at the beginning of every Clue game she's going to win. And she does. Every single time. She's one of these that win because she can con the rest of us, misdirect the rest of us, while she's figuring out who did it, with what, and where. Okay? It involves deception. Edwardsville basketball involves deception. Okay, what's a head fake? It's a lie, isn't it? Yes! Yes, open the door. Open the door. Edwards, the best head fake in Edwardsville basketball is a lie.
It's not even worthy of my entering this discussion.
Okay, a play in football. Let's just take a play in football. The average play in football unfolds this way. You want the defense to think what? You're going to the right when really you're going to the left. You want the defense to think you're going to run when you're going to pass. It's very simple.
Are you saying it's a sin to run a flea flicker? No, I
am saying that every game,
not end of discussion.
Every game involves deception. Poker, it is the essence of deception. Think about, go home and think about this and feel guilty for the rest of your life.
Is it sinful? Yes or no?
I'm not at that point yet.
Okay.
I'm not at that point yet. There is no game on the face of the earth, even, well, let me think. Candyland. You played Candyland with the kids, right? I'm trying to think how you play Candyland. There's no deception in Candyland. Chutes and ladders? No. You want to know why? Those are games of chance. Games of... No.
No deception.
Wait a minute. But because it's a game of pure...
I got lots of games for you.
It's a game of pure chance. It either involves the pagan reliance upon this mystery god, Fortunatus, luck... Or it involves deception. Every game in the world. I stand by my thesis. I can be corrected. Anybody wants to correct me, feel free to do so. I should have thought of this 35 minutes ago. But she wrote me so long ago, and I wrote back, and I said, you know, I cannot think of a game that doesn't either involve luck. And there are some Christians who won't even say good luck to one another because they consider that kind of a heathen practice. And I guess at the very bottom it is. There is no such thing as luck. There's absolutely no such thing as luck. There is such a thing as probability, but Scripture clearly teaches that God is the master of probability. Man casts the dice, God determines the outcome. Either luck or deception. And I'll stick by this Edwardsville basketball thing to my dying day unless someone could show me that a head fake isn't deception. Now, it may be to a trivial end, you know, because it is just a game. And the other guy is in the game knowing he's going to be deceived. Everybody understands that the game is about deception, be it football. Oh, I thought of another one. Bowling. Bowling perhaps may be the only pure Christian game there is in the world because it involves no deception. Any game that you maybe play against yourself. I don't know. I will get email about this. I will. Christians around the world, thousands of Christians around the world gathered this past Sunday to celebrate what many other Christians celebrated the week before Easter. Let's find out more from the Associated Press.
Thousands mark the Orthodox Easter Sunday. In Russia, throngs gathered to mark the occasion. President Vladimir Putin spoke at one service and told the crowd the day brings joy and hope. The Orthodox Church was banned under the Soviet Union, but has made a major resurgence since 1991. And in Jerusalem, hundreds of pilgrims took part in Orthodox Christian ceremonies for the holiday. A procession to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was followed by Mass. The church is shared by a number of denominations that guard the responsibilities under a network of agreements hammered out over the last millennium. The shrine marks the site where tradition says Jesus was crucified and buried. The Orthodox Church celebrates the Easter festivities 1 week after most Christians because their church uses the Gregorian calendar. Craig Smith, the Associated Press.
I don't know if that was going to play. Don't they use the Julian calendar? I think we use the Gregorian calendar. They use the Julian calendar. And yes, Gene Smith will clear it up for us tomorrow on the program. The other thing that I might note is that the Orthodox don't call it Easter. They call it Pascha. And they're pretty careful about that. Colombians are gathering to pray around what they say is an image of Jesus Christ on the inside wall of a woman's house that appeared on Easter. This is from the AP.
Something very hot and a lot of peace in her body when she discovered this image on the wall of her Colombian home. The homeowner believes it's the image of Jesus Christ. She says it appeared on Easter morning, the day when Christians celebrate what they believe was the resurrection of Jesus. Dozens of people have been visiting her house to pray in front of the image. The Catholic Church says it will carry out tests to determine the authenticity of the image.
But
the local bishop says, we interpret this as a sign and a call that Jesus Christ is making us to contribute in his kingdom, working for justice, peace, and love. Carlotta Bradley, The Associated Press.
What do you do? Because the bishop already said it's a sign. He already said it's a sign from God. And yet the church is still going to investigate this picture of Jesus. It's not actually a picture of Jesus. It looks to me like a water stain. We have them all around this building. Hey, I hadn't even thought of that. When we get done here today, you and I will go to my office. Your office is even better because you have a more water stained office than the rest of us. Let's go see if we can find it. Maybe something appeared over the Easter holiday that we should be taking note of. A sign. Oh, I talked about this before. You know, Paul says there's some people looking for signs and there's some people looking for wisdom, but we preach Christ and him crucified. If it's a sign of anything, a picture of Jesus appearing there, one would hope that it would be clear enough to say, this isn't just Jesus calling us to hope and justice and love for our neighbor. This is the Jesus who lived and died and lives again for you, for sinners. You ever noticed that? These things of Jesus, when they appear, very seldom are they images of Christ crucified. It's always his face. A really nice headshot. Kind of like a graduation picture. Sign of what? Maybe it's a sign the lady needs to have her roof fixed. How about that? Most logical conclusion. When we come back, a sermon review, an Easter sermon by Pastor Bill Swirla.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.